I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings,
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a link to becoming a Patreon sponsor yourself. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are going to have the final edition, part three, of our sixth anniversary special. So we do this every year. The podcast started on July 2nd, 2017, 6 years ago. And every July or August, we are now in September, actually. But right around this time, I try to have an anniversary show where we play some of my favorite clips over the last 6 years of podcasts. And it usually goes two or three episodes because we got so many clips to share. So this will be part three of our sixth anniversary special, and I hope you guys enjoyed the last two parts. We did not have a show last week because we had a hurricane scare out here in Tampa. Hurricane Idalia, I believe, was the hurricane that was coming through. Fortunately, it did not hit where I live in Tampa, Florida, but it did go up to the panhandle, like around Tallahassee, and I believe they got hit there. Things were delayed for a couple days because of the hurricane scare that we went through. Everybody was told to evacuate. I did not evacuate, but had to do a lot of moving of stuff, you know, just in case we had floods. But fortunately, we had nothing. It was way off coast, and so we really didn't get any wind. It was just raining like a regular thunderstorm and no flooding at all. So I got very, very fortunate. But anyway, it seems like we go through this now every year. I've been out here in Tampa for, let's see, I think this is my 13th year. Yeah, actually, it's about 13 years since I moved here in 2010. We've had like two real big hurricanes coming through since I've been here, and now this was another one. So it seems like it's happening more and more frequently now with the weather changing and things like that. So anyways, that's why we delayed part three of our anniversary special. So I'm glad to finally be able to get that out to you guys today. I got some bad news in the bodybuilding world. I just saw this the other day on Dave Palumbo's Facebook page. Lisa Lyon, who was a pioneer in the field of women's bodybuilding, probably really the first woman bodybuilder. She was not Miss Olympia or anything like that, but Lisa was the first one to go out into the mainstream, first woman to be a female bodybuilder. And she really got a lot of media attention. She was featured in Arnold's book, Arnold's Body Shaping for Women. She posed for Playboy. She had, who was Robert Mapplethorpe, took some famous pictures of her. So Lisa was the one who really opened the door to women's bodybuilding. And I guess she is now suffering from pancreatic cancer and is very bad condition. Dave put a link on there from TMZ Sports, and they had an exclusive on there. This was a couple days ago. So very, very bad news for Lisa Lyon. I never got a chance to meet her, never got a chance to interview her, but this is very sad. I don't know if she can pull out of this. It looks like from the short article that she's in really bad shape. So sorry to hear that about one of the pioneers of our sport for sure. What else is going on? I've got that 12-week transformation challenge that I mentioned a couple times on the show. This will be the last week for it. So if any of you guys are interested, I had a couple people reach out to me. So thank you for the ones that did reach out. I'm giving a discount for my 12-week transformation challenge. This is where I will write up a nutrition program and an exercise program, a workout program for you. And we will do weekly check-ins with photos and measurements and everything to make sure that you are making progress over the next 3 months. So now that summer is officially over, Labor Day is tomorrow, we can start getting in shape again, right? Summer vacations are over. So it's time to focus on ourselves now and get in shape. So if any of you guys are out there are interested in doing that, just shoot me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com and mention the transformation challenge in your email, and I will tell you how to get started on that. All right. Before we get to our clips for our third anniversary show, I did get a couple emails. So again, if you guys have any emails for me, you can send those to the same address, naturalolympia@gmail.com. So I want to read these emails that we got here for this week. This one comes from Rich Francis. Rich says, "Hey, John, I've listened to your show since its inception. I came across this interview with Ken Waller on YouTube. I'm not sure how this guy managed to land him, as from what I know, Waller does very few interviews. Unfortunately, the interviewer seemed to rely on Wikipedia for the interview questions and had very little background knowledge about Waller. It would be great if you might find out how this guy landed the Waller interview. You're such a better interviewer and undoubtedly know more about Waller out of the box about him than this interviewer did even before doing research. I knew a lot more about Waller than this guy did. Ken was the captain of the 1963 Western Kentucky football team that won the Peach Bowl. He also mentions that he stopped training when he got custody of his son, who I remember was a pretty good hoops player at Western Kentucky as well." Yeah, I did see that interview. That was by Carlos, who does the Bookworm. I believe it's the Bookworm show on YouTube. And he does a lot of, like what I do, a lot of old school interviews. The way he got that was he contacted Mark Martinez, who was promoting his movie Dream Big. And he got an interview with Ken Sprague. And then Ken, I think, reached out to Ken Waller. And you're right, Ken does very few interviews. I've never seen any interviews with Ken. I've tried to get Ken on this show many, many times and was not able to even reach him. So I think Ken Sprague was instrumental in setting that up. And I think the reason they wanted to do the interview was kind of to promote Mark's movie, because Ken Sprague and Ken Waller are both featured prominently in the movie. And they were kind of disappointed that he didn't ask many questions to Ken Sprague about the movie. So I'm not really sure how the Waller interview went. I listened to a part of it, or one of the clips, but I didn't listen to all of them. So yeah, I would love to interview Ken Waller, because he was definitely a big, big part of that golden era of bodybuilding and, you know, all the titles that he won in the IFBB and the AAU as well. He would be a great, great interview. Plus his friendship with Arnold and Pumping Iron and all that stuff. Definitely a big part of the golden era, like I said. All right. This email says, "Hey, John, I've been enthusiastically following your podcast and videos online since 2017. From my own bodybuilding experiences since 1966, age 18, you are the most avid fan of the sport with your rich knowledge and passion of bodybuilding history. I particularly like the way you're beginning to diversify your podcast by reading magazine articles. Jerry Branham is one of my favorite guests you have. He has indefatigable anecdotes that are entertaining, hilarious, and ultimately illuminating, as he was there in the heyday with Arnold and Franco. As an interviewer, you're always very respectful of your guests and never speak over them. You're also quite impartial and willing to consider both sides of the story, most evident in your various discussions of the notorious 1980 Mr. Olympia with Roger Walker and Wayne Gallish interviews. Regarding your videos, I'm inspired how you emphasize old school training with dumbbells and compound exercises. I also notice how serious you are in the gym compared to the iPhone generation of trainers perpetually moping about glued to their devices." Yeah, that's true. You can always see them in the background in my videos. "Keep up the good work, John, with your podcast and training videos. You're definitely passing on the baton of knowledge to us younger generations. I'm 45 myself. Best regards, Peter Schuler from Australia." All right. Thank you very much, Peter. Glad you're enjoying the podcast and the videos. And thanks for being such an avid fan. And I will keep them going. Yeah, I love Jerry too. In fact, we've got a clip here from Jerry with this show as well, because Jerry is like one of my favorite guests. All right, guys, you ready to get started? Here is part three of our sixth anniversary show. And we are going to start with Jerry Branham. Speaking of Jerry Branham, this was an interview Jerry and I did about the year 1971. As you know, at the end of each year, or the beginning of the new year, I should say, we go back 50 years, 40 years, and 30 years into the past. And we talk about the competitions that took place. So I believe this was in 2022 when Jerry and I were talking about 1971 and 1981 and 1991. So we were talking about the 1971 NAVA Mr. Universe in this clip. And we're talking about Bill Pearl winning his last NAVA Mr. Universe over Frank Zane and Reg Park and Sergio Oliva. So here we go.
Now we go up to 71, and, you know, there's Bill Pearl showing up, and, you know, Arthur Jones, Sergio had done some business with Arthur Jones of the Nautilus Company.
Yeah.
And Arthur Jones was saying in all the magazines that Sergio would destroy Bill Pearl.
Yeah.
You know, because Arthur Jones actually knew Bill Pearl pretty well, too. He had done a movie with Bill Pearl, in 1959, somewhere in the Deep South. It was some sort of vampire movie or a zombie movie. It was a zombie movie. So, you know, I mean, Arthur Jones was writing in all the magazines that Sergio was a, you know, freak of nature, and he was going to just absolutely destroy Bill Pearl. And of course, you know, the truth is Sergio entered and he was big. But if you look at the photos, Sergio looked kind of smooth. He wasn't really ripped. Now, it wasn't that Bill Pearl was ripped. He was kind of smooth in the legs, too. I mean, his legs didn't have much muscularity. But he did have, like, perfect symmetry. I mean, his proportion and symmetry were excellent.
Yeah.
He posed really well. And for him, at 41, he was probably in the best shape of his life.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. You know,
now, later on, Frank Zane complained because when they were doing the comparisons, you know, they were supposed to turn to the right, turn to the left. Bill Pearl refused to turn. I think it was he only wanted to stay in one direction on the side thing to show his strength.
To the left, I think, yeah.
Yeah, he refused to turn. And Frank Zane pointed out that the the judges allowed him to get away with it. It's kind of a similar situation to when Arnold competed in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah.
He was doing all these shenanigans on the stage, like Franco coming out and toweling him off.
Yeah.
When he was on, I mean, this is not allowed in bodybuilding competition.
Right.
You can't just walk up on stage and towel another guy off.
Yeah.
When the judges tell you to turn to the side or turn to the front, you can't stand there and not listen to them. I mean, Oscar State, do you remember Oscar State?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Oscar State used to be the head judge in the IFBB. If that was Oscar State at that show, he would have said, Bill Pearl, turn to the left, turn to the, if Bill Pearl just stood there, he would have yelled.
Yeah.
He said, Bill, turn to the left now. He would have yelled, embarrassed him.
Right.
You know, but the judges just let him get away with it, according to Frank Zane. I wasn't there. This is Frank Zane talking.
Yeah, yeah.
So Frank Zane was trying to basically say that he felt that the contest was a bit fixed.
Yeah.
Bill Pearl.
Now, well, I know those NAVA judges love Bill Pearl.
Just they absolutely love him. Bill Pearl was like a god to them.
Yeah. When he showed up for a contest, it was like, whoa.
Bill Pearl. They loved Bill Pearl. It's true.
Yeah.
You know, and Bill Pearl tells a story. He wrote an autobiography later on, and he tells a story how they were preparing to pose backstage, and you know, Sergio was pumping up nearby, and a little kid came up to Sergio and asked him for an autograph, and Sergio, which he did to me. I know this story is true because Sergio did the same thing to me years before.
Get the fuck out of my face.
Get the fuck out of my face. Get away from me. Get the fuck out of here. Tells this to a little kid about 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
Bill Pearl overheard this, right? Then the kid goes up to Bill Pearl, asks him the same question. Bill Pearl not only, you know, gives him an autograph, but, you know, picks him up and, you know, takes a photo with him.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that that kid's father
was one of the judges.
Was one of the judges. And so Bill Pearl used that to show that you should always act nice to people.
Right.
You never tell who you're dealing with, which was true.
Right.
So you have to wonder, did that play a role into what, you know, Sergio losing to Bill Pearl? Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
it did. I don't know. But I know that myself, I mean, I have to admit, Bill Pearl was my idol when I was a kid, you know, my first bodybuilding idol. And when I look at the photos, I have to give Bill Pearl an edge. Honestly, objectively, as great as I think Sergio was, even though I didn't think much of him personally, I do give him credit. I always do, as one of the greatest freakiest, as I said earlier, one of the greatest bodybuilders ever, one of the most genetically gifted by far. But in that show, I believe Bill Pearl was in better, quote unquote, contest condition.
Yeah.
Bill Pearl had peaked for that contest. Bill Pearl was the best he could be for his physique, where Sergio was not at his best. Now, I will add that if Sergio had you know, put his ego aside and dropped down maybe, 10 pounds, no more than that, and entered shredded, I believe he would have beaten Bill Pearl. He would have destroyed him, as Arthur Jones would have predicted. In other words, let me put it this way, to put it make clearer. If Sergio had competed in the 71 universe looking like he did at the Essen Olympia, was it 72?
The next year.
You remember how good he looked that year?
Yeah.
He would have absolutely wiped Bill Pearl off the stage, even with the Brit. The British judges, whoever they would have had to give it to Sergio, because it would look ridiculous.
All right. And then continuing that discussion about the NABBA universe in 1971, Jerry and I also talked about the 1971 Mr. Olympia, which took place, I believe, 1 or 2 weeks later. I think it was a week later. And this was held in Paris, France. So the NABBA universe, of course, is always held in London, England. And this was 1 week later in Paris, France. It was promoted by Serge Nubre. And Arnold, as we know, went into the show. This was his second Olympia win. And everybody was expecting a rematch between him and Sergio. And Sergio did come over to, he flew over to Paris to compete. And he was not allowed to compete because the Weeders started a new rule with the IFBB that if you competed outside the organization, like in NABBA, then you would be suspended from the IFBB. So Arnold ended up winning this contest unopposed. There was no other competition. He was the only one in the contest. So Jerry and I talk about that. We were expecting the big showdown between Arnold and Sergio, but because Sergio went over and competed in the NABBA universe, this was the year where Joe Weider said, or Ben Weider, I should say, the IFBB said, if you compete outside the IFBB, you will be suspended.
Right.
As a professional. If you're a professional bodybuilder and you compete outside the IFBB, you will be suspended. So, you know, Sergio, that's the reason why they said Arnold couldn't compete against Bill Pearl.
But you realize that that's a monopoly. That's actually illegal with Ben Weider.
Yeah.
That's a monopoly. It's illegal to do that. But I don't think Ben Weider realized that.
Yeah.
You know.
So that was the excuse that Arnold, they said that Arnold couldn't compete against Bill Pearl, but you were saying it might have been that Joe Weider was worried that Arnold would lose to Bill Pearl because of the way Bill Pearl was treated.
Yeah, he didn't want to take a chance. Yeah.
So Sergio supposedly, I guess, didn't know about this. Yeah. And he comes over from London. He goes over to Paris, France to compete in the Mr. Olympia. And then they tell him when he gets there that he can't compete. Right. But they said he could guest pose if he signs a letter saying that he's sorry that he, you know, that he went over. So they allowed him to guest pose. So now Wayne Galash was there, and I talked to Wayne, and Wayne said it was such a shame they didn't allow him to compete because he looked way better at the Mr. Olympia than he did a week earlier at the NABBA universe. Wayne said that he was probably holding water from the flight over to Europe and at the London universe. And then by the time he got to the Olympia, he said Sergio looked dramatically better. So we didn't get a chance to see Sergio versus Arnold, but the audience gets to see him guest pose, and they only competed three times, 69, 70, and 72. Here was another year where they could have competed against each other. And, you know, what a waste.
It would have been interesting if Sergio had been allowed to be beaten.
Because I have to say that Arnold, and I'm sure you've seen the pictures, looked amazing that year. Yeah. I mean, what a difference from a year ago, from 1970. He looked bigger than ever, but ripped. His legs were shredded. His legs looked amazing.
Right. That's
true. I asked Wayne if Arnold would have competed in NABBA universe. Do you think he would have beat Bill Pearl? And Wayne really didn't want to say, but he said he thinks he would have beat Bill Pearl.
Yeah.
I do too.
I kind of would have to go with that too. Yeah.
His back was better. His legs were better.
Unless, again, you know, the judges were so enamored of Bill.
Yeah.
They gave it to him anyway over Arnold. That's always a possibility, you know, I mean.
But it really seemed like Arnold was really in shape that year in 1971, you know.
Yeah.
But maybe because he thought he was going up against Bill Pearl. Maybe that's why he got in such great shape.
Could be. Yeah. Although, you know, he was also very concerned about Sergio Arnold.
Yeah.
I mean, Arnold was extremely impressed by Sergio, you know.
Yeah, and he beat him the year before, but maybe he wanted to make sure that he was going to beat him again, you know.
I mean, yeah, he was always in awe of Sergio all the way through. I mean, you know, never escaped him. Even when he beat Sergio, he was always in awe of the guy.
Now, Franco was also at the Mr. Olympia, and he was also not allowed to compete. I read in Randy Roach's book, they suspended Franco for competing in, of all things, the AAU Mr. World in 1970, a year earlier.
That's right.
But Arnold was competing in that contest too, so I don't know why. I have no idea why they suspended Franco.
Now, that's weird.
Yeah.
How could Arnold, competing in the same venue,
Yeah.
Allowed to compete, and Franco is not allowed to compete.
And they didn't even have the rule a year ago. They just started the rule in 1971. So
that needs to be explained. There's something really wrong with that, really.
And then Franco won the Mr. World that year and in the IFBB. So
No, it's all ad hoc.
Yeah. I
mean, all this stuff they just make out of the top of the heads.
Yeah.
I mean Ben Weider. And all due respect, he ruled it like some sort of dictator.
Dictatorship, yeah.
Anything he wanted just went right on the spot. You know, this guy can't compete, that guy can't compete.
He's making up the rules as they go along.
With no rhyme or reason, just because he wanted it that way.
Right. You know?
I mean, so that's just the way it was. I mean, surprising that some people have spoken about it, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's just the way it was.
Yeah. Right? So Franco was also allowed to guest pose and – So
well, you know, it's still going on to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
look at Sean Roden.
Yeah. I mean,
they didn't allow him to compete because he got accused of a crime. Accused.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the reigning Mr. Olympia. He was not judged guilty by a court of law.
Yeah.
And you know, the way it works is you know, innocent until proven guilty. That's the whole basis of the legal system in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, for them to say the incumbent, this is not the guy, like the guy was in 10th place. This was the guy who had won the title. He wanted
the year before. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And for them to say that you can't compete was, again, dead wrong.
Yeah.
Dead wrong. Sean Ray has gone on record as saying, well, it would have been embarrassing. That's a bunch of crap. I mean, first of all, he cites football players who got in legal trouble, weren't allowed to play.
Yeah.
But the football players still got their salaries. They still made money. Sean Roden lost everything.
Yeah.
All his contracts, everything. It was just completely unfair. So my point is this kind of crap, even after all these years, it still goes on.
Yeah.
It still goes on.
Well, you think back then, too, 50 years ago, they didn't have social media. So nobody even knew this stuff was going on until they read it in the magazines.
That's right.
And people couldn't go on, you know, Facebook or Twitter and complain about it, you know. And then there was, you know, the judge or the IFBB never felt any heat because.
That's true.
It wasn't. It was. And then Muscle Builder, of course, wouldn't really talk about it.
You know? Yeah, it would do it. Now, think about it. If there was social media back then, the examples you just showed, somebody would have probably picked up on it and say, hey, wait a minute. How is it that Arnold's allowed to compete?
Right.
Frankly, when they both compete in the same venue.
And everybody would have criticized the IFBB. Yeah.
See, they got away with it because of the fact that they're used, like you said, the magazines were controlled.
Yeah.
And it was underplayed. Nobody.
But you didn't get the news until 6 months later.
Right. Nobody knew about it. Yeah. By that time, by that time, they say, screw it.
Yeah.
Right. Let it go, you know?
Right. All right, our next interview is with Robert Nalon. Now, Robert Nalon, for those of you who used to read the old magazines, was a great photographer from Australia, and he was prominently featured in Muscle Mag. In fact, when they had those Muscle Mag annuals, which I believe was 76, 77, 78, and 79, they only had four of them. Robert routinely had a lot of articles in there about Arnold, about meeting Arnold and Arnold staying with him in Australia when he was traveling over there, guest posing. And they were really, really fascinating articles. So Robert is a fantastic photographer. He's been in the business a long, long time. And he's been around. He met all the greats. He met Arnold and Zane and Larry Scott and all the great guys, Dave Draper, Reg Park. So it was a real pleasure to talk to Robert. I believe this was an interview we did a couple of years ago. And he's going to start off talking about meeting Arnold in Australia way back in 1972. So here is Robert Nalon. When did Arnold first come out to Australia?
Arnold came out in 1972.
Him
and Franco. And it was up in Queensland, a place called Surfers Paradise. Mm. And I think it was the Mr. Southern Universe that was on. And him and Franco gave an exhibition, and I sort of hung out with him a bit up there, took some photographs with him and odds and ends, and then Franco came back to Sydney. Arnold flew back to LA, and I trained with Franco. I took him home for lunch. We went out to the movies, a few things like that.
Wow, that's great. Now, was that when Arnold and Franco were posing by the pool, where Arnold had those blue trunks
on? Yeah, they're by the pool, yeah. That's mm-hmm. right.
Yeah, I remember seeing
I
that.
I think Wayne took a movie. I took a movie. I took a few stills.
Okay.
And then the next time it came out was in 1974.
Now, what part of the year in 72 when they came out, what part of the year was that? Was that the summer before the Olympia or was that after?
Well, that could have been April. Got a March, April, something like that.
Oh, March or April, okay. Yeah, because Arnold was in great shape for that.
It's still quite warm, because our season's the complete opposite of yours. It's,
right.
It's coming on to winter now here, and it's coming on to summer over there.
Yeah, right, exactly. So tell me your impressions of Arnold and Franco when you got to meet them. That had to be pretty exciting, because they were probably the two biggest bodybuilding stars in the world back then.
Yeah. Well, Arnold was still a bit smooth in 72, but... Mm-hmm. Well, he's off season. You can't expect you can't be in shape all year round, can you?
Right, right.
And but he still looked big, you know, and very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance?
And big.
Yeah, I remember seeing that video. I thought he looked great. I remember when I was a kid watching that video, and when he was standing there and he hit that front double bicep, it's like his whole body just exploded, you know.
Actually, I took a movie when he first came out at Sydney Airport in the journalist room, and I got him to nobody's seen this movie. I've still got it.
Really?
I haven't done anything with it. I was thinking of putting a DVD together
with
a story and putting that on it, and plus all the other stuff I took.
Yeah, you really should. That'd be great. I'd buy it.
I got him to pose. He took his singlet off. It was quite a good little movie.
Yeah. What did you think of Arnold when you got a chance to meet him with his personality and stuff?
Well, the funny thing is, he was in a lot of the English magazines. Mm-hmm. As soon as he came to England, they took photographs of him. George Greenwood was probably the number one photographer. And he took photos of Reeves, got back in 1950. That's how far back he went. But he took the side chest shots on the white background. Do you remember seeing those?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. When he was young?
Yeah, well, they were the first really good shots Arnold ever had taken. And they were all put in. George had a magazine called Man's World, and there was another one, Health and Strength. And all Arnold's photos were in there. And I used to send a lot of photographs of Australian bodybuilders, plus myself, to the magazines. And they would, in return, they would either give me a subscription to the magazine or... they would send me photos. Or George Greenwood would send me photos.
Okay.
And Arnold said to George once, he said, who's that guy on with the photo in the magazine? And he told him. Anyway, when he first came, I never met him. He said, hello, Robert. I thought, oh, I've never met him. And that's because of the photos in the magazine.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then we sort of struck up a friendship from there.
Yeah, because you guys had a pretty good friendship. I remember reading a lot of articles in Robert Kennedy's Muscle Mag. And I thought they were really entertaining, where Arnold would come to Australia and you guys would hang out and you went into detail about the workouts and what you guys did together. I thought that was really, really entertaining.
The promoter who brought him out was very busy. He was doing a lot of things. So he said to me, do you mind driving him around or taking him out? So I took him to the movies. We went a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Took him into town to buy a dress for his girlfriend at that particular time. Took him home for lunch, home for dinner, down to the gym to train, and got to know him well. We went everywhere.
So, yeah. What was his training like when you guys went to the gym? Tell me about that.
Well, as I said, it was his off season. He was training hard, but not that hard. So I trained with him quite a few times. At one time, we were training twice a day, and in the morning and the afternoon.
Okay.
And I think that was when he was, before he's going to enter for the Olympia.
So what did you guys train? Well, how was the workouts pretty much similar to what he said he did in the magazines?
Oh, yeah. He put a lot of effort into it. I remember one time where he was doing heavy squats and chins, and he was a heavy squatter, and his legs were big. Everybody says, oh, his legs are small, but I saw them huge, you know.
Really?
And we were doing calves, and I think he pumped his calves about 20 inches. And
wow.
They were quite small when he started, and Reg Park said, you've got to work your legs, and he did.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about all those rumors where they said he had calf implants?
No, I don't know. I looked at his calves and they were quite normal to me. I didn't see any marks or anything like that. And he pumped them up and he really worked hard. Worked hard on them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you were right there. Yeah. You saw him up close, so you would know the best.
So there's a lot of stories going around, a lot of rumors going around about everybody. If you believe everything, you know, it's, people make stories up anyway, just to make an impact on somebody, you know.
Now, you said he squatted heavy. How much was he squatting back then?
Oh, God. See, we're into metrics and kilos and all that now, but I was raised, my time was pounds and stuff like that. So probably 400.
400? Okay, yeah.
He went up, and that was just a training session.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I saw his legs blow right up. But
really?
It's like everybody. We all have a part that goes down quick. And I'd say his legs were probably the type that would go down quick.
Right, that was one of his.
But they'd come up quick too.
Mm-hmm. Right. How about when he did chest and stuff? How much was he bench pressing and incline pressing and things like that?
I can't remember that much, but a reasonable weight.
Yeah.
Not excessive, just enough to do the exercise, 4-6 sets or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could have been 200-300, something like that.
And you guys seem to get along really, really good, right? I mean, your personalities and stuff.
Oh, yeah, we got on great, you know. And obviously I was the one that drove him around and looked after him and things like that. And we got on. We were really good friends.
Yeah. And I remember, Robert, you were always in the nice cars. You always had those nice Corvettes. Did you have a Corvette back then?
Yes. Well, over here, all the cars are right-hand drive, like England. I bought a Corvette. It was left-hand drive, but you could only register it and that down in Canberra, which is the Australian Capital Territory. That was the only place you could do it. So I had to drive down there and register the left-hand drive, and eventually I converted it to right-hand drive at a cost. But when I had the Corvette, I used to drive them around in that. And it's just sit in the passenger seat and just be quite happy.
Yeah. So how what do you think of his personality? You know, because now we know Arnold is like one of the most famous people in the world in the history, but he wasn't, you know, he was the best bodybuilder in the world back then, but not many people knew him. So he had all this drive and he had all these goals that he had in mind.
He was very strong-willed.
Okay.
He knew what he wanted and aimed for it and got it.
Yeah. Did he share that with you when you were talking to him, like some of his desires and his goals? Did he talk about acting at all?
God, when I knew him, he was doing a course, a business and administration or something like that.
Right.
And when I was in Los Angeles for a while, I went with him to some talk shows up in CBS in Hollywood. And he was quite good with that in being, you know, talking. And I remember on one show there was Vincent Price and another guy called I can't remember his name. He was an English actor. But Arnold came on. He's full of personality and he came across well.
Yeah, he always did great on the talk shows.
And one year when he was making was it The Villain with Kirk Douglas? We went up to Hollywood and he a place called Nudies that this guy made all the cowboy outfits and stuff like that. He made them for John Wayne, Gary Cooper, and Kirk Douglas was in the film for him, with him as well. And I took a lot of shots there that day. And then we walked outside and he met a director, the guy, I think he's called Hal Needham. He made Smokey and the Bandit.
Right.
So I took photos of him and Hal. And if he saw somebody, he'd want a photo, I'd take it.
Yeah. So that's cool. You were with him back in 79 then, too, when he was making that movie.
Yeah, well, I went to the Olympia in 78 when Zane won it. I was in 79 and I went in 81. And the one in 80 at the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that
I was taking photos all the time, day and night. I've got a heap of photos nobody's ever seen.
Wow.
Which I intend to print this year and put them on different sites.
Are you going to sell those photos from the 80 Olympia, or are you going to just put them on social media?
I just put them up. I've given everything to my son, and he wants to put some books together.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you really should.
And I bought a lot of negatives from people who were in the audience as well. It cost me a bit of money, but I got everything that you can think of. Color slides, black and white negs, you know.
Wow.
Everything. So
yeah.
I'm keeping them all ready for the right time.
Yeah, well, I can't wait
again,
to see them.
And again, you can't judge by photographs. You have to be there.
Right, right.
And you, at that show, you had all the audience had all different stars that they liked. They liked Mensa, they liked Chris Dickinson, they liked Arnold. And in those days, people would boo if they didn't like the person that won or came second or whatever. And that seemed to be a standard thing after that year, even when I went to the States in Columbus in 81.
Oh, that was terrible.
When Franco right. won, they all booed with that.
So. Oh, God, yeah. Well, since you brought up the 80 Olympia, let's talk about that. Did you talk to Arnold, or did you see Arnold before the contest when he got to Australia?
He was very distant that year. I took my girlfriend and introduced him to her, but he was just preoccupied with pumping up and with the contest, and he just sort of grunted, and that was it. But I just let him go, and I thought, you can't communicate with him at this time, so all I did was just take photos.
Okay. So what were your thoughts? You were there at the show, and this is now 40 years later. This is 2020.
Look, I didn't get involved with the politics or who should have won or who should or the placings or anything like that. I picked Zane up from the airport, took him to his motel, drove him to the contest, and drove him back. But he trained in my gym twice a day when I had it, and he was looking good. But I personally think he was a little bit light, and I heard he had an accident a couple of months before.
Right.
And he said, what do you think? I said, Frank, you look great, but you know, you need to be like 10 pounds heavier. But he did look great. He posed well. He came across well.
Okay.
I would have put him second.
Okay.
That's just my personal preference.
Yeah, yeah.
Arnold wasn't in 100% shape. Give him another 6 months, I think he would have blown them all away.
Yeah, I do too.
But he probably made his mind up at the last moment, and nobody knew that he was going to enter.
Right.
So it was a surprise, and there was a lot of conflict there backstage with Mensa. There was really a fight that happened. Arnold said a few things to Mike, and Mike said a few things to him, and everything got heated, and I thought, oh, God, here we go. Anyway, it was all resolved. Joe and Ben sorted it out, so it was all right.
Great. Were you there backstage when that happened?
Just a little bit away from that, but I heard everything.
You heard everything. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. There's a lot of pictures on the sites too that show.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So now you saw Arnold in 1974, which was probably his best year. And then you see him in 1980.
He was big then. Yeah. That's the shot I took down near the Opera House. I took a hell of a lot that day. It was I think he came straight from the airport and went over there. And the journalists wanted to interview him, and they took a few photographs as well. And it was a really cold day, or cold morning. It was overcast, and there was frost on the grass, and he didn't want to take his shoes off because it was too cold. So I thought, well, it doesn't matter as long as I take the photographs. That's
right.
The most important thing. So I got some good ones. I would have liked to have taken a lot more, but it was too cold, and he just wanted to go.
Right. That's 74.
And I
about.
Did, yeah. And we went. Then we went over to a place called Luna Park at Coney Island. It was like it's still going. It's been going for 100 years or so. And I took some photographs of him in front of the funny mirror, you know, where they're all warped and you look all different. You look fat or thin or whatever. So I took a couple of shots in the mirror and just standing there.
Yeah, I remember those shots. Those are pretty cool. Yeah.
I've probably taken over 100 shots just on that 74, 75.
No kidding. You see him in 1980, and when you saw him on stage, what did you think? What was your initial thoughts?
Well, he looked impressive. And Reg Park was a judge, and he came up to me, and I said, what do you think, Reg? He said, well, Arnold's the tallest and he's the biggest. And all eyes go to Arnold. That's what Reg said. So he was a bit bloated at the pre-judging, but at the night competition, he was sharp. Okay. He lost a lot of fluid.
And that was all done in one day, right, Robert? They had the pre-judging and night show all on the same day, right?
Yeah, I had the pre-judging, yeah, and when that was over in the afternoon, I took photographs of him walking through the foyer, other things. Joe Gold was there selling all his World Gym T-shirts. Mm-hmm. Quite a few people there.
Was that also the picture where he's talking to Waller at the table?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Yeah, I wonder what
actually, there's a girl in the middle, and I had to cut her out and splice the photo together.
Oh, really? Why'd you have to do that?
It just didn't look right. Anyway.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you see Arnold on stage, and what did you think, like, when you saw him when he first came out?
Oh, I thought he looked good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are very critical of what he looked like because he wasn't the Arnold they all saw in, like, mm-hmm. 74 and
right.
When he won the Olympia.
Right.
You know, or 73 or 71. I think 71 and 74 were his biggest years. Mm-hmm. 73, he was really cut and looked finished, you know.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
They're the best times. I didn't like him in 75 that much, mm-hmm. although he still looked good, but... And that was supposed to be his last contest.
Right, right. So you said in 80, you would have Zane second. Would you have Arnold first?
Well, look, that's just my opinion. Everybody mm-hmm. says no, but I think I've got a good eye. And mm-hmm. being a bodybuilder and going through diet and everything like that, and
right.
I know what it's like. And I've been to all the contests in America backstage, and I even said to Zane once, I said, God, Frank is so small compared to these. Look at Cal Skalic. He's got 22-inch arms, and what are you going to do? He said, well, we get out on stage. And being a true professional, he stood right, tanned and cut up to ribbons.
Right,
and
right.
all the eyes went to Frank. So what
right.
I'm saying, all the eyes went to Arnold in 1980,
mm-hmm.
even though he wasn't the Arnold we all remember being the best. And but he still looked impressive.
Right,
right. So look, everybody's personal preference, who they like, what they expect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an individual thing.
So if you were a judge, if your personal preference, just your opinion, how would you have placed the top five in that?
Look, if I was a judge, it would be a different thing altogether. I'd be sitting on the panel observing, but I spent most of my time taking photos, so
right. okay.
I really can't comment to who should have won or who the placings or whatever. But there are a lot of them that looked great, a lot of them looked good, a lot of them didn't look so good. But it was a tough competition.
Yeah.
They all say, oh, it's political and he shouldn't have won, but I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just, look, you could get several different judges and you get all different places.
Right, right.
And you can't, there's no such thing, and I don't believe on the judging, the point system, because I believe in the old days, it used to be, you'd get, say, 6 or 10 bodybuilders and he'd eliminate them. And,
mm-hmm.
and then you say, you, the rest step back and he'd keep doing that, comparison by elimination. And it wouldn't take long at all. But
right.
the point system goes on forever.
Right, right.
You could judge a dive on a springboard or something like that with points. That's
mm-hmm.
a different thing. But you can't judge a physique competition on points.
Right, I agree.
Definitely
I think
not. It's a comparison by elimination. And,
yeah.
You know, until you get the first, second, and third.
Right, right.
And they all go down the line now like, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th. Who cares? The first, second, and third are the main ones.
Right. What did you think of Chris Dickerson that year when he competed in the 80 Olympia?
Look, Chris was a very nice guy and everything like that, but I didn't like his physique. He
mm-hmm.
had great calves. His arms were too small. You know, his arms looked to me about 16 and a half or something. And most of the guys there, like Boyer Coe, had great arms, you know.
Right,
fantastic.
Right.
And you couldn't compare the arm. But
yeah.
But everybody seemed to like Chris's physique. And I'm just a little bit different. I look at things differently.
What did you think of him?
Oh, Boyer, yeah. Boyer looked good, yeah. He probably should have gone higher, but look, as I said, I wasn't a judge, and I don't know what they pick, what they look for.
Right,
everybody's
right.
got their own type of physique that they like.
Yeah.
But as I said, you know, just got to compare them and just all do the same poses and just see who looks the best.
Mm-hmm.
Can't beat Arnold on a side chest pose, can you?
No, or a front double bicep.
Who can equal that pose in all that contest? None of them,
no. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Today they don't do a really good side chest.
No, they don't. That's where I thought he had an advantage because he was so tall and so wide, and when he hit those arm shots or the side chest shot, he just seemed like he dwarfed everybody.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, and he's tall. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. He didn't have a big frame. He actually quite narrow shoulders, but when he, you know, expanded, I said, yeah, you look a bit narrow, and then he put his arms up. I thought, God, you are wide. And, you know, and with the delts, and it all makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you about Mike Mentzer, because that was his last show, and he was a very popular bodybuilder at the time. And he was in great shape for that contest also, right?
Well, a lot of people say the reason he stopped was because of that show, but I don't believe that. I think he was probably had enough and he'd done enough and he's just ready to retire.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to know Mike really well. And I took a lot of shots of him in the gym. And I took a movie of him as a guest poser when he came out here. And
okay.
I still got that. So he looked quite good. And
was
nice
that
guy, too. Very cooperative.
Was that same year, Robert? Was that in 1980 when he guest posed?
No, I think I took the shots when he came. It could have been 78, 9, something like that. I can't remember.
It's okay.
I have to look on the film, and I've probably got the date on that.
Okay. So you got to hang out with him a little bit, too, when he came to Australia.
Oh, not much with Mike, because he had his girlfriend with him at the time, and he was with her most of the time. I just down again here and there in the gym, backstage or something like that, you know.
Okay.
But I did get to hang out with Larry Scott for a long time.
Oh, okay. That's right. I saw some pictures of you and him before, yeah.
Yeah, well, I wasn't in shape. I'm never in shape when people come out to train with, but at least you got to train with them. That was the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So how was that? What did you learn from Larry?
Well, I did shoulders and arms with Larry, and that was like the highlight of my life.
Yeah, really?
Because I always thought he looked great. But Larry had narrow shoulders, but he had huge delts, which, you know, you didn't notice that much.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me once, he said, I wish I was big again. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, I said, your arms are over, you're about 20 and a half now or something. He said, oh, they used to be 22, pumped.
Wow.
And some of those shots, when you see him years ago, he looked phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I have a friend that was at the first and second Olympia he won in New York. And he said the crowd went crazy. He said, I've never heard an applause so much, so loud as with Larry Scott.
Yeah.
In the Olympia. He said, even to this day, there's never been anybody that's really captivated the audience. Larry had something special, even though he wasn't tall, or I think he was about 5'8" and a half. And, but he went to the maximum with size.
Right.
Maybe a little bit smooth for this era, but still very impressive.
All right. That was great stuff. If you haven't heard that whole interview with Robert, be sure to check out the full interview. I'm going to have a link below, guys, with all our interviews that's on our website. So check out that link if you've missed some of our old interviews. And like I said before, they're not all on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, but you can get the link off of my podcast, The Bodybuilding Legend Show, under the podcast link. Okay, this next interview was done with Tom Terwilliger, Phil Williams, and Jerry Branum. And we did an interesting show where we talked about all the mandatory poses that they use in bodybuilding: front double bicep, the front lat spread, side chest, side tricep, abdominal pose, most muscular, etc. And we talked about who was the best bodybuilder in that pose. And this was, of course, limited to the 70s and the 80s. We did not go into the 90s or the recent guys. We just stayed with the golden era And so in this clip, Tom Terwilliger, Phil Williams, Jerry Branham, and myself pick who we thought had the best front double biceps pose in the sport of bodybuilding from all the guys from the 1970s and 80s. All right, here we go. All right, well, let's get started. We are going to limit our discussion, as what our show is all about. We're going to limit our discussion to the 70s and 80s. We're not going to talk about the 90s bodybuilders or beyond. We're just going to stick with the golden age, the 70s and 80s. So let's take the front double bicep pose first. I was thinking along the lines of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger looks fantastic in this pose. Robbie Robinson and Sergio Oliva and maybe even Boyer Coe. What do you guys think? Who would be your choice for the best front double bicep of the golden era?
Well, I think if we had to go from that particular group, I would have to go. I think I would have to. I know it's going to sound cliche and like kowtowing, but I'd have to go with Schwarzenegger. However, I think I would probably have to throw someone else in there who also competed in the later 70s with those same competitors well into the 80s. I competed with him in a Mr. Olympia competition, which was Samir Banot, who had a fantastic front double bicep and very complete. Even as I look at Arnold in that front double bicep, there are areas, you know, going by a slightly different standard, that just there's some weaknesses in there a little bit. His lats might have been a little high. Samir had a great balance. I don't know if he'd win that pose down or not, but I have to throw him in the mix for just a little interest.
Okay.
Also, let me jump in by, you know, just to underscore what Tom just said. If you really look closely at Arnold, let's say Arnold compared to Samir, right? Arnold had this tremendous bicep development. I mean, it was overwhelming. There's no question about it. In fact, when I worked out with Arnold a couple of times, he used to finish his arm workout. He'd go like this, like he just put his arms out like that. I'd never seen arms that big in that pose. I mean, they were immense. But the thing I remember about Arnold is that if you really look at him carefully, he was bicep dominant. His tricep was good, but not that great. Now, Samir, he had better balance. He had the bicep and Samir had tremendous. Am I right, Tom?
Great balance.
Tremendous tricep development.
Yeah, right, triceps.
So if you went strictly by the balance, you know, of everything, Samir would actually have better arms than Arnold. But of course, Arnold was bigger, so people would right off the bat say, "Well, Arnold's got bigger arms. We're getting Arnold's better." But not if you really look at it. If you analyze it carefully, what do you think about that, Phil? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I very rarely saw good tricep poses or pictures of Arnold. Now, Samir had beautiful triceps and a, you know, full complete biceps. Like you said, they weren't outstanding or overly large. But yeah, overall, I think he may have had a better arm.
That's a good point. Now, think about it. How many pictures have you seen of Arnold where he's kind of really highlighting the tricep, like a side tricep? But you very rarely see it.
Yeah.
Triceps, I'm not saying they were weak, but they weren't outstanding compared to his biceps were absolutely outstanding. In fact,
tricep dominant.
I always tell people when Arnold, in between shows, when he was competing, he would his body would literally disappear. There'd be no delts, no pecs, no thighs. There'd be only two muscles left, the biceps and the calves. That's it. Everything else is gone. I'm serious. But he had this, still have these giant biceps sticking out.
Right.
Now, I will say this because I want to go back to that list again. I can't remember everyone on the list, but I do remember Boyer Coe because I was coming up as a bodybuilder, I remember Boyer Coe. I think I won the world, and Chris Dickerson the same night won the America. It was something like that. And Jerry, you might remember that better, but I remember seeing pictures in the magazines of the two, like the two of them, two different contests, same night. And I remember Boyer Coe, even though he was lacking, and one of the reasons I like Boyer, because I lacked that same midsection structure. I didn't have the classic abdominals like Phil has. He was just fantastic abs, man. But those biceps and triceps on Boyer Coe. Now, granted, it's not a complete balanced-looking physique up there. But you talk about arms, man. That guy had some guns, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the best.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even today.
What about Robbie? Because everybody thought, you know, Robbie had the best front double bicep.
My vote is Robbie first.
Okay.
100%, especially in the 70s. Robbie, I saw that, and that just blew me away.
Yeah.
As a teenager, I saw that, and that just blew me away completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I liked Arnold, but he was 6 foot one. I'm 5'6" and a half. So I looked at Robbie, and I looked at Samir. And between the two of them, I tried to do as much as I could to look like Robbie in this way or Samir as much as I can. I tried to copy those two physiques.
Yeah.
Robbie is another guy who had very balanced bicep and tricep, and his peak, the peak on his bicep was incredible. Also, yeah. Tremendous, you know.
So, plus, he had that tiny waist, and he had the good thighs, so he had that flare here, and then the flare on the legs.
I mean, he had tremendous, and always in shape.
Yeah,
always looks good. You know, I mean, the only problem with Robbie was, you know, when he competed against Zane, as you know, John, he, for some reason, he kind of lost it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe 2 days before the contest, he'd start to get a little bit smooth. It's not that he looked bad, but Zane comes in there looking like a freaking ripped statue.
Yeah. And so,
you know, he always managed to beat Robbie because of that. You know, if Robbie, everyone who was around at that time, they always say if Robbie would have came in at his 100% best, he would have beaten Zane. Then it's hard to say if that's true or not, but I've heard a lot of people say that.
I saw Lee Haney posted a picture of Robbie yesterday. It had to be like from 75, 76, and he was on that muscle rock, you know, where everybody used to pose. Yeah. But, man, he looked incredible. He has that tiny waist, the flaring lats, the great arms, and the great legs. I mean, it was just everything tied in together, you know?
Right, that's true.
Yeah, I think if we put it to a vote using that group,
yeah,
and I'm glad I threw Samir in there because he certainly deserves to be in there. But I think I have to go with Phil on this one. I think Robbie, overall balance at his best, double bicep.
What about Sergio? Would you put Sergio in that group?
No.
At his best? No?
I would not. And I'll tell you why. Sergio had gigantic arms. There's no question about it. I mean,
bigger than his head.
I mean, I used to wonder when I looked at pictures of Sergio, I used to wonder whether he had a shrunken head.
Right.
Bicep, Tom, do you remember that? When he did a double on bicep, his head looked like a pea sometimes.
Disappear.
Yeah. But you know, but if you look at, again, if you really are objective and you just look at his arms, he had like kind of like big ham-like arms. He didn't have any separation except rare occasions between the bicep and tricep. Strangely, as he got older later on, after his major victories, he's like, for example, that contest where everyone thought he should have won. And was it Essen? Remember the year?
Yeah, with his, Essen, Germany.
He actually did have separation between his bicep. But most of the time, when he flexed the arms, if you look at the photos, they were like big ham-like arms. He didn't have delineation and separation that the other guys, especially a guy like Boyer Coe, like Tom mentioned, this guy had separation everywhere. Mm-hmm. Bicep, every possible line and delineation was seen.
And the separation in Boyer's tricep when he hit that shot.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just like, whoa. It's like it stood out as much and separated as much as the bicep, which I always thought was really impressive, really impressive. So I have a question, though, before we really put this to a vote, and maybe we have already. Are we just primarily 70s? Because there's some guys in the 80s. I mean,
bring some guys in the 80s. Out of it. I can think of any guys in the 80s.
Yeah, mention some guys in the 80s. That's true. That's all right.
Right? If we pull in the 80s a little bit.
Well, we got Lee Haney.
Yeah, we have
Haney had great frontal bicep.
Yeah.
You
know?
And maybe not. I still probably would give it to Robbie Robinson, even over Haney.
I agree. You know? I agree.
He had better arms, yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course,
you had Mike Christian. You had
and Mike Christian didn't have a bad upfront bicep, but it wasn't great. His lats were too high, a little too narrow.
Yeah.
Gary Strydom's lats were too narrow for
Lee Labrada.
A really great. Yeah, Lee Labrada had a great.
Labrada's great front double bicep. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
We had Sean Ray. Sean Ray was in the 80s. Bill Hill was in the 80s.
Right.
Bill Hill was an early monster. I remember him.
Yeah.
I became friends with Phil Hill, you know, and I remember, well, I think it might have been the Nationals one year. I was in his hotel room. He wanted to watch me. Well, he wanted me to look at his posing routine. And I'm looking at this guy. I'm thinking, my God, this guy's huge.
He was unbelievable.
He had these gigantic thighs, Bill. You got to see him. I mean, you
remember that. Yeah.
This guy reminded me almost like a precursor for Paul Dillette. He was like he's like one of the really thick guys, and Paul took it to a whole different level, Dillette. You know, but we're not talking about the 90s. Yeah. So I can't talk about Paul.
I remember one thing about Phil, and if you noticed this, he was very narrow-shouldered considering the size that he had. Yeah. Do you remember that, Jerry?
That's true.
Very narrow clavicles.
Right, that's very true, and I think that's what held him back, to tell you the truth, because the thickness was way above anyone. I mean, I think I was there when he won the Night of the Champions. Very thick.
at that time, no one was that thick. You didn't.
He definitely set a new standard for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he had right. And that narrow shoulder thing held him back a little bit.
He had, you know, had vascularity and veins everywhere. I mean, the guy looked. And you know what? I'll tell you a funny story quickly about Phil. Years later, I was in New York again to cover the Night of the Champions. I think it was the late 90s or something. And I ran into Phil in a restaurant, Phil Hill. And he came up to me. He said, Jerry, he says, you know, I'm having a problem. I said, what's going on, Phil? He says, I want to go back, you know, and compete, but I just can't get in shape anymore. He says, I just can't get that level of, you know, that I had before. And he says, I think it's because, you know, I think it's because I stayed on the drugs too long, you know, and I don't respond to them anymore. So I said, well, that's very possible, Phil. I said, the only thing I can tell you is lay off them for a while, just train naturally, and then maybe when you go on them again, they'll work. And I never spoke to him afterwards, and he never competed again, so I don't know what happened to him. But
well, yeah, Jerry.
What? Bill was interesting. When I was doing Muscle Sport USA, we did the interview the year of the Nationals. Did he won the heavyweight.
Right.
Did Sean Ray win the overall?
Sean beat him.
Yes. He won the overall.
He did. Okay. Because I remember interviewing Phil, and I thought he said something interesting. I said, so what's in the future for Phil? He said, well, I'm going to take my pro career as far as I can. I'm aiming for the Olympia. I want to win the Olympia. And I said, what's beyond that? What's beyond a bodybuilding career? He goes, I want to become the mayor of Trenton, New Jersey.
I remember that.
Too. Yeah.
This was his goal. This was his bigger goal, was politics. Yeah. I don't know if he ever got there or not, but who knows?
You know, Phil was a well-spoken guy when you spoke to him. He sounded like an intelligent guy.
Very.
I could see him. I mean, look at what Arnold did. Governor, you know what I mean? I could see him going into politics. You know, he was very well-spoken, Phil.
And he knew how to play it up too. He would wear, everybody else was wearing, you know, the typical gym wear, warm up wear after the contest during the interview. He had a cardigan on and the big thick black glasses.
Yeah, I remember the glasses.
Like, you look like you could be the mayor. I don't know, maybe.
The last I heard of him, that he was working as a guard in a prison somewhere, and I don't remember where I heard that, but that was so many years ago. I can't remember who told me. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that was the last I've heard of him.
What about Vince Taylor? Vince Taylor had a great front double bicep.
He did. Vince Taylor,
absolutely. Incredible arms.
Yeah. They're great.
Incredible arms.
You know, I'll tell you a quick story about Vince. When I met him, he had just come over from Germany. He was living in Germany, and he was a protege of John Brown. Remember John Brown? John basically saw him. And I guess Vince was originally from Maryland somewhere. And he ran into John Brown, and John Brown convinced him, you know, to go into, but he saw the natural ability of Vince. And, you know, so he'd come over to compete in the Nationals. And I was, again, working for Weider. And I interviewed, me and Julian Schmidt, we interviewed Vince Taylor. And the guy was tremendous. He had a fantastic physique. And he says to me and Julian, he says, you know, I said, just like you asked Tom. I said to him, well, what's up for you? What's up the line for you, Vince, in bodybuilding? I mean, you're going to turn pro and this and that. He says, you know, I'm not good enough to be a pro. I said, what? He says, I'm just not as good as these other guys. I just can't. I don't see myself ever beating them. I never forgot that. He wound up competing. God knows how many pro shows. He thought he was not good enough to be even on the stage with these guys.
Oh, dude, he pissed everyone off. And I guess it was 91 Grand Prix post-Olympia. And we were all, you know, it was like 7 countries in 2 weeks. It was nuts. And everybody's like trying to stay in shape, you know. And it was him and Sonny Schmidt, first and second for the first 3-4 shows. Yeah. Well, then Sonny got a hold of some illicit, you know, some stuff. And he went downhill fast. But Vince would piss everybody off because literally he was in incredible shape, and he would get on the bus. We had to take a bus from one country to the other overnight sometimes, and he would get on the bus with 2-3 pieces of pizza, slices of pizza. Anywhere he could get pizza, and it didn't matter if we were in Italy, Germany. He came on the bus with pizza. I think he did it to taunt the rest of us, man. Son of a bitch, man. We're all eating broccoli.
Oh, man. Wow. That reminds me of Eduardo. Remember Eduardo Kowak, guys? You remember?
Oh, of course. I liked Eduardo. What a great guy.
I was on one of those things. I was covering one of those same Grand Prix tours that you were just talking about, Tom. We were in Essen, Germany again. I became good friends with Eduardo Kawak. You know, he brought me to his gym in Nice and all that. But, you know, we were hanging out in the hotel one night, and he says to me, "Let's get something to eat." So we go in to a – the only thing we find open was a kind of McDonald's-type restaurant. Now, remember, the contest was the next day, right? He orders, like, a bunch of cheeseburgers and fries. And I said, "Eduardo, should you be eating this stuff? We got a contest tomorrow morning." I mean, he was just loading up on all this crap. And, you know? And I said to myself, "Oh, my God, he's going to look like crap at the contest." And, at the contest, the guy looks fantastic. I mean, no water retention, nothing. Those crazy deep abs. Remember those abs he had?
Oh, my God, the abs.
I forgot to mention him. I'll mention him in that with Robbie. Marta Kowak had a great front double bicep.
He really did, didn't he?
Great arms.
Great biceps.
Great arms. Incredible arms.
And like you, Phil, he was one of the few guys that could actually – like he had abs in his front double bicep.
While he was stretched out.
I remember your front double bicep, Phil. I'm like, the freaking guy's got his rib cage up, and he's still got these deep abs. How is it possible? And Kowak used to do the same thing. We had the same exact look, man. He had a definitely great –
Great body. Olympia was the best condition I'd ever seen him, and he didn't place in the top 16.
Eduardo had and if you think about it, this guy had one of the most complete physiques.
Yes, sir.
Points.
He had no weak points.
Huh? He had arms, no weak points. Calves, everything. How did this guy not do better? I can never figure that out. You know, he had a great physique, you know.
What about Lance Dreyer?
He had too much hair.
Oh, Lance Dreyer. Sure. You can't mention him. He had gigantic arms.
Good front double bicep, right?
Very, very good double bicep.
Kind of wide waist, though. A little bit of wide waist.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Lance's problem was he was a little too blocky.
Yeah.
He was thick in the waist. But arm size and mass, tremendous. Tremendous.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, I think – doesn't Lance have a PhD? I mean, he's –
Last time
I met with him, it was at the some Hall of Fame event I was at.
Yeah.
And man, that guy, he is one smart dude.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think he went all the way with his PhD. So based on that, we might have to give him best double bicep. Smartest. We'll give him the smartest front double bicep.
Let's call him most knowledgeable bicep.
Most knowledgeable. I like it. A special category. We're creating a special category for Lance Dreyer.
Here's a guy I want to mention I forgot about. To me, Mike Mincer.
Oh, yeah.
Tremendous front double bicep with that vacuum.
Yeah, that's true. He had a great vacuum.
He did.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, my God.
You know, Mike had a very small looking waist, didn't he?
He had small hips.
Yeah, small hips. Yeah. You know, really is. I remember the 80 Olympia where he was like standing next to Arnold. He made Arnold look like he had a really thick waist because Mike's waist looked about 2-3 inches smaller than Arnold. Of course, he was shorter too, but still, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing, John. See, and as I'm looking back now, just in my mind of Mike Mencher's physique in that front double bicep, it was like a small waist. I thought he had big hips. It's just like his waist came down and his hips.
Maybe he had a small waist and big hips. You're right.
He had wide hips for a small waist.
Right. Wide hips,
You're right, Tom. You're right. Yeah. I've noticed that. And they said, well, he has wide hips. They said this years ago. And I said, well, he has a small waist, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they said, oh, well, his hips are still wide. I'm thinking, if your waist is small.
Who cares?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But it did seem to throw the symmetry a little bit, somehow or other. And then, you know, he wore those big, thick, velvety trunks. It didn't help.
Yeah. Right. he had a great vacuum, though. I remember, like, when he would come out and do his posing thing, I saw some videos of him. And when he would come out with those arms stretched out or the front double bicep, it was like, ooh, it put you back in your seat, you know, because he had that vacuum and he had the huge arms.
There were few guys back then that could do an overhead vacuum along with Frank Zane and Tony Pearson, and there were a few others who had that tremendous overhead vacuum. And I used to look at that and go, oh, what does it take to do that?
Oh, I know.
And I just...
One of my buddies, you guys all know, and of course, he was a great 80s bodybuilder himself.
I know who you're talking about, John Defendez.
John Defendez, exactly. Great vacuum. One of the best. One of the best
I've ever seen.
Right. Yep. But you know, the funny thing is, the vacuum is coming back today in the so-called classic men's competition. And you don't see it in any of the pros. None of the other guys, none of them are doing vacuum. They can't, not one can do the vacuum. Right? The classic, it's almost becoming like a style, you know, to show that I can do a vacuum. Like this guy who won, whose name I always forget, the guy who just won again, the classic.
The big tall guy. Bumstead. What's his name?
Chris
Bumstead. Is that?
Bumstead.
Yeah.
He, and that's one of his, and every time he does a double bicep, he does the vacuum every single time, if you look at it.
Which is interesting, because when you think about classic bodybuilding and you talk about the workouts, every classic bodybuilder from day one practically included heavy pullovers. We were expanding the rib cage, right? We wanted to create a bigger torso. John, you've had one of the big, I never saw you do a vacuum, but you got like one of the biggest rib cages. Yeah. You must have been doing a lot of those pullovers.
Well, I did those pullovers from 14 years old. I think that's how I did it.
I don't know if they're doing them today. It seems like it's an exercise that's kind of forgotten.
They do the thing with the rope. They pull the rope, but they don't do a pullover with a dumbbell.
Yeah, but then again, how many other guys today really can do a great chest pose like Arnold used to do in those guys?
Yeah, we're going to get to that side chest. Yeah, that's a forgotten pose. Yeah,
you don't see many guys today who look. I mean, Phil Heath does one, but all you see is his arms and shoulders. It's not like the old days when the guys had these gigantic, like Reg Park, all these gigantic rib bones.
Big rib kit. Yeah, it looks so impressive.
Well,
let's vote. Let's vote on the front double bicep.
Okay. All right.
So, Phil, you're going with Robbie then, right?
Number one, my opinion. Number one, I'll go with that.
How about you, Tom? You go with Robbie, too?
I mean, we really threw a lot of guys in the mix, but I think as a whole, Robbie Robinson, man. The tiny waist, the incredible arms, great lats. Yeah.
All right. What about you, Jerry?
I'm going to go with, it looks like I'm kissing ass here, but I have to agree with the other guys. I'm going to go with Robbie.
Okay.
Because again, I'm looking at the from a medical point, I'm looking at the balance.
Yeah.
Well, the beautiful balance between the bicep and tricep. I mean, half of me wants to give it to Arnold because Arnold had this just tremendous double arm bicep, but he didn't have the balance between bicep and tricep that Robbie has.
Right.
Yeah. I have to give it to Robbie for that reason.
Okay. Yeah.
What about you, John? You got
I'm going to go with Arnold. I'm a big Arnold fan, but I'm thinking of that. I think it was the 70 NABBA Universe. There was a black and white photo of him doing a front double bicep, and he's got the big rib cage. He's got the great arms. He's got the lats, and his legs looked really good then too.
Mm.
So, I mean, just I used to look at that pose all the time, that picture all the time when I was growing up, you know, trying to develop my physique. So
I'm
an Arnold fan. I'm going to go with Arnold. So, but it looks like Robbie won that one. 3-1.
Got it. Okay. I'm making notes here.
All right. That was great. We should do another show like that because that was really fun doing that interview with Tom and Phil and Jerry. And I do have to mention, and I did not think about this until after the interview was over, we missed a really, really great bodybuilder in the front double bicep. And that was Brian Buchanan with that tiny waist. I don't know how we forgot about Brian Buchanan, but we really screwed up on there. So Brian, of course, won the 1984 NABBA Mr. Universe, and then he went over to the IFBB in the late 80s in 1988, and he made really quite a splash. He was a great, great bodybuilder, and his front double bicep pose was just amazing because he had that super tiny waist. It looked like his waist was 26 inches. So, yeah, we dropped the ball on that one, that's for sure. All right, this was one of my favorite interviews, and we had a clip with him last show, and this was Jack Neary. So I did a two-part interview with Jack Neary, who was a great writer in Muscle Builder magazine. And right around the time that I got started in the sport, which was 1977, Jack started working for Joe Weider in 1976. And he was from Canada. And so in this clip here, Jack talks about meeting Joe Weider and how he got his job writing for Muscle Builder magazine.
Thanks, John. I'm really honored to be asked. And I think you're doing a great thing with this podcast. It's nice to capture some of the memories of the guys who lived in the golden days.
Absolutely.
So, you know, really happy to be included in that group.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you joining me. Well, Jack, let's start from the beginning. How did you get into writing? How did you get into eventually working for Joe Weider?
Well, I had taken up weight training as a teenager when I was playing high school football in Calgary, Alberta, which is in the west side of Canada. And, you know, I just gravitated towards Muscle Builder and Power magazine on the newsstands, started reading it religiously. was captivated by the world painted by luminary writers at the time, you know, Dick Tyler, Rick Wayne, Armin Tanney, Gene Mosé, all those guys, was really caught up in that, in the scene that they recreated for me, the California scene. Yeah. Of course, when you look back at what bodybuilding was then versus what it is today, you know, it didn't really enjoy the widespread popularity that it does now. Weight training was something that was kind of frowned on. Now, of course, athletes in every sport embrace weight training. Mm-hmm. You know, in those days, it was kind of on the fringe. There was a knock against it. It made you muscle bound, all of those kind of myths.
Yeah.
But it was a very small, insular world. And there was something very special about that. And I became caught up in it just reading the magazine through the Weider publications. Mm-hmm. And the other, you know, Perry Raider's Iron Man and Dan Lurie's magazine and all the different mags of the day.
Yeah.
And I actually started as a sports writer on a daily newspaper in Calgary at a young age while I was still a teenager.
Oh,
and
wow.
So that's how I got my start. I was a kind of a reporter for covering different sports for the daily newspaper. And was training, lifting weights on my own, and, you know, was just a real fan of bodybuilding, was a huge Arnold fan, and, mm-hmm. you know, all of the guys, Sergio Leve, all Franco, all the guys of that time.
Right.
And I thought, you know what, I'd like to work for Joe. I think I could write for this guy. And so I actually put together a letter of introduction. You know, I'm just 20 years old at the time, and I included a bunch of cuttings of sports articles that I'd written from the daily newspaper. And I sent them off to Joe, and I never really expected to get a reply.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard after the fact that it was Rick Wayne who was working with Joe and saw these clippings and said to Joe, wow, this kid can really write. You should bring him down for an interview to California.
Mm-hmm.
So I was stunned. About a week later, I got a call out of the blue from Joe's secretary, a woman, a German woman named Annalisa. I'll never forget her. And she said, Mr. Weider was really impressed by your package and would like you to fly down and meet him.
Wow.
I couldn't believe this. You know, I was absolutely knocked onto my ass. You know, this was crazy. And so she made the arrangements and I flew down and I arrived at the Woodland Hills Temple there, Weider Health and Fitness. And I'm sure you've been there. And I was waiting in the lobby, very nervous, sweaty palms, the whole thing. I was going to, you know, one of the giants of the business, Joe Weider. And I, you know, if you remember the lobby, it had this kind of grand spiral staircase that swept down from the editorial offices down into the lobby. And there were these enormous, larger than life, full body oil painting portraits of some of the greats of the time, Arnold, Larry Scott, and Rick Wayne.
Wow.
And it was like this pantheon of the gods. I was looking up and just in total awe.
Right.
And after a short wait, Joe Weider himself came striding down this great staircase. And of course, Joe at that time was no stranger at putting himself, his own pictures in the magazine. He loved the publicity.
Yeah.
And I had this impression of him as this very distinguished looking older guy in his mid-50s, you know, with the coiffed hair and the walrus mm-hmm. mustache. And then, of course, he opened his mouth, and that's when the first big surprise came. It was his voice.
Yeah.
It wasn't at all what I expected. He said, hello, how are you? Did you have a good trip? And it was this high-pitched, crackling sort of voice that was really kind of unnerving to listen to, not at all what I expected.
Right.
And of course, I learned later that everyone who had met Joe had a Joe Weider imitation.
Right.
Arnold had a very good one. He was very good at imitating Joe. So Joe said, would you like to go to lunch? And so we went into, he was driving a white Lincoln Continental Mark IV, a very grand car at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me to this nearby restaurant. There was this really nice sunny courtyard. There was a waterfall and it was really pretty grand. And, you know, I'm just some punk kid from the prairies who you know, didn't know any better.
Right.
And here I was in the mecca of bodybuilding. And Joe said, do you want some artichokes? And I said, what? And he said, you want some artichokes? And Joe loved artichokes. And I, as I said, I'm just this kid. I'd never had an artichoke in my life, let alone heard of one. And so we had artichokes for lunch and a couple other things. And Joe asked me a bunch of questions about my work and my writing. And I guess I answered them satisfactorily. And he entertained me over lunch with stories of his growing up as this poor kid in the Jewish ghetto of Montreal. And he liked the fact that I was a fellow Canadian. I mean, I think that was a little bit of a bond there, right, even though he'd been living in the States for many, many years.
Yeah.
But he would tell the stories of how he used to go down. He was very, very poor, but he would go down to the old rail yard looking for scrap metal so he could make himself these makeshift barbells out of the wheels from the trains. And, you know, I can't imagine he actually lifted wheels from the trains, because those are pretty heavy, but he said he did. You know, we went back to the office and he said, I'm going to give you a test assignment. I want you to meet Franco Colombo and do an interview with him and do a story about his shoulder training routine. So somebody drove me here. I don't know how I got there, but I got to Franco's house. It was a beautiful sunny day. It was in his backyard. He just actually qualified to become a chiropractor. So he was very, you know, proud of himself for that, and was a big deal in his life. He was married.
Jack, about 76.
Would have been May of 76.
Okay.
And forgive me if I get some of the dates wrong along the way here. It's 45 years ago.
Right.
Some of the things are a little fuzzy, but I do remember certain landmark things. And so I interviewed Franco. I had a little tape recorder. I interviewed him. He was very charming, very gracious, very generous with his time. I met his wife, Anita, at the time, who also was a chiropractor.
Right.
And I flew back to Calgary the next day, and I worked on my story. I sent it back down to Joe, and I didn't hear anything for a while, and I got a little bit worried. And I heard later that Joe really wasn't all that crazy about the story I wrote. I don't know if I just didn't like it that much, or I don't know what. Rick kept bugging him, he's good. He's a good writer. You should give him a shot. Give him a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joe ended up hiring me, obviously, and I didn't even have a car in those days, and I just got my driver's license, and I bought an old Volvo, a car, and I drove down from Calgary the 1,700 miles to Los Angeles and settled into this amazing new chapter in my life.
Wow.
And I really have to say I owe a huge debt of gratitude to Rick, who became a mentor for me, and we shared a tremendous passion in for writers, not just bodybuilding, but for the new journalism and, great writers like Norman Mailer and Hunter S. Thompson, George Plimpton, guys like that. We were both great fans of that. And I think that formed a bond, and he kind of took me under his wing and showed me the ropes.
I'm glad you mentioned the writing, because that's what really got me into bodybuilding when I was a kid. I started when I was 14 in 1977. And I remember reading Rick. Rick was a fantastic writer. I remember reading your articles. And the articles were so well written. And I miss the magazines today, of course. But what I really missed was those in-depth articles that you guys wrote. And you really felt like you got to know the different personalities of these guys. And we only got to see them if we went to the contest. So I remember I went to the Mr. Olympia in 1977. And when they came out, you felt like you knew everybody, because you read all the articles and you knew all about their personalities,
Well, that's a great insight into what we were trying to do on the magazine. I mean, I was never one of those straight in nuts and bolts reporters that just gave you the facts about a training routine or the diet of a particular guy. I mean, I wanted to give you bring the reader into behind the scenes, give you a bit of the color and the context for what the guys were thinking and feeling and heading into contests and what was going on backstage and in the hotel rooms as they prepped. And, that's something I took some pride in working on. And that kind of journalism was a little bit unusual for the time in those magazines.
It's great that you were influenced by those great writers like Hunter S. Thompson and, Norman Mailer and stuff,
I didn't have the lifestyle of Hunter S. Thompson, but I certainly admired his work. And I know Rick did too.
All right. And continuing with Jack Neary, Jack told this great story, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard the story, but I wanted to repeat it here for those of you that missed it. This is the story of Cal Scalak and his feud with Joe Weider. So Cal was being featured quite prominently in Joe Weider's Muscle Builder magazine. Every month, Joe was putting pictures and articles about Cal, because Cal had just won the 1977 Mr. Universe contest, the heavyweight class. He beat out Mike Mentzer. It was a real surprise upset. Everybody was predicting Mentzer to win the show, but Cal beat him. So Cal was the new upcoming bodybuilder, and Joe was featuring him in the magazine. And I guess they had an argument about payment. Like, Cal was not getting the payment that Joe promised him. So this is a great story about how Cal went into the Weider offices and took his pictures back. All right, here we go.
But I'll tell you one story your listeners may want to hear about. I witnessed the famous Cal Scolic incident with Joe Weider.
Oh, yeah.
Where they butted heads.
Okay.
It was a crazy moment. So Cal, I can't remember if this, well, I guess this would have been after the 77 universe, you know, world championships. Cal had won it.
I was going to ask if it was before the 78 Olympia when he did the crucifix.
Yeah, the famous crucifix. Yeah. So just leading up to the 78 Olympia.
Okay.
And, you know, Cal, he was a really nice guy, had a lovely wife who was from the Dutch Indonesian islands, Malacca.
Right.
Really lovely guy, really strong. And I interviewed him a number of times. We became pretty friendly. But Cal was a very straight, real straight shooter. He's kind of a no-nonsense straight shooter.
Mm-hmm.
He was very honest, very unvarnished. And, you know, Joe was a guy, Joe liked to be liked. And Joe would like to make promises he never intended to keep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he even told me, and I was nothing in terms of like being a bodybuilder. I mean, I used to train as a power lifter. I was really into lifting, but was never anything to write home about.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe would say, if you keep up the training, I'm going to give you $50,000 and put you on the cover of the magazine. And then and I think, and he's saying this to me, you know, and I go, come on, Joe. So, you know, he would make promises, and I guess he'd made a few promises to Cal that were not, as far as Cal was concerned, were not coming true. I don't know what they were, and I wasn't privy to those conversations. But I think Cal's nose was out of joint because, you know, I think he felt like Joe was saying all this stuff, and the stuff wasn't forthcoming, whatever that was.
Yeah.
And I remember it was in the winter. It was a rainy day. It was quite quiet. Joe had a couple offices in the editorial part of the Weider and Health and Fitness building. He had his big office. It was all mahogany paneled in a huge boardroom. And those places were like the inner sanctum. They were like museums. He would had all this artwork, and he had one of the first revolutionary flags of the American Revolution framed. You know, it's a priceless artifact.
Yeah,
he had beautiful Frederick Remington bronze statues of Western life, like the cowboys and Indians and all that, and buffalo and all that kind of stuff.
Right,
worth a fortune. And but where Joe spent most of his time was at a little table in the center of the art studio, in the design studio, where the art directors would work in terms of putting together the magazine every month. You know, these are the art directors that designed the pages and laid out the photographs and all that stuff, you know, kind of the nerve center mm-hmm. of the operation. And Joe used to sit there and hold court, and he used to put a loop in his eye and he'd look at these contact sheets. This is the days before digital, of course. And he would look at negatives, and I'll say one thing about Joe. He wasn't just a great bodybuilding fan. He was a great publisher. He really loved publishing, and he knew it. And he knew how to turn out a good magazine. He always made a good product, and he had many years of that under his belt. And he had a good eye for good photography, and used to drive Artie Zeller nuts and guys like that. But he would circle on the contacts and the negatives. This is a good one. Crop it here, crop it there. He would direct the art directors on how to make the stuff look even better.
Yeah.
And so Joe would spend a lot of time sitting there in the kind of the nerve center, in full view of everyone. It was all these glass enclosed offices. And, you know, Cal came in through the back door. Normally someone coming in from the street would come in through the front reception, let the receptionist know I'm here to see Mr. Weider, et cetera. But Cal knew there was a side door that led into the warehouse. Mm-hmm. And then there was a big metal staircase that went up into the back side of the editorial offices. So he could come in and bypass the reception. So one day, Cal Scolic, he's wearing an Adidas tracksuit, you know, zip top suit. And he comes storming in, and he's got a head. He's red faced and angry. And he started yelling at Joe. They had a few words like you're not keeping your promises, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm there with Joe. I'm witnessing this whole thing. And then Cal made a beeline into this little room adjacent, which was the photo library. And it wasn't a very sophisticated place. It was just a bunch of filing cabinets stuffed with prints of photos that had run in Joe's magazines over the years. And they were all broken down by bodybuilder alphabetically.
Okay.
And so Cal scoops up all the S's, like his stuff, as well as all the Arnold photos and a bunch of other guys, the Zane photos and the Rick Wayne photos. Jeez. And he's got just armfuls of photos. Like, I'm talking about thousands of photos in his arms, bursting out. And he comes running back through the studio to make a getaway. And Joe says, "You're not getting away with those." And Joe, I got to give Joe credit. You know, he was a 57-year-old guy. He lifted weights a bit, but he was nothing like Cal Skolic in terms of formidable physique.
Right.
And he stood right there and stood his ground. And Cal ran into him like a rhino charging and just, bam, hit him, like sent Joe flying, sent a bunch of the photos flying across the room. But Cal quickly scooped up the ones on the floor and he grabbed me his armfuls and then went down the back stairs again and got in his car and zoomed it off.
Wow.
And he made off with all these photos, like, I'm taking them.
Wow. Okay.
And of course, Joe was apoplectic. He was beside himself, you know, like, call the cops, this is robbery, you know, the whole thing, you know, quite dramatic.
Right.
And of course, Joe had his lawyers and there was lawyers involved. And a few days go by and kind of heads cool. And I got word from Cal, "You can meet me in the parking lot of the Santa Monica airport and I'll hand over the photos to you." And so I drive my old Volvo in there. He's got his Camaro or whatever he was driving then. And it was like this clandestine drug deal. You know, he hands over these photos to me and they're all bent and wrinkled and stuff from the violence. And I take them back to Joe the next day and they pursued a lawsuit. I never quite knew how it was resolved, but I think Joe ended up having to pay Cal some money and to make him go away. But that was a pretty memorable day, I must say.
Yeah, I always heard rumors about that story, but I never talked to anybody who was there. So that's awesome. That's
great. Yeah.
All right. That was great. I love that interview with Jack Neary. One of my favorite interviews that I've done over the last 6 years. He was such a great storyteller and a fantastic writer. Him and Rick Wayne, definitely my favorite writers in the bodybuilding field. All right. This next clip, this was a great interview I did. I was very, very proud and happy to do this interview. This was with Lee Haney, Sean Ray, Lee Labrada, and Rich Gaspari. I had them all on at the same time. I think this was not last year, but the year before, probably 2021. This was right before the Mr. Olympia, and all these guys were going to be backstage doing commentary on the show. So I got them all on my show, and while I had them there, I asked them all, what was their favorite Mr. Olympia contest that they competed in? So they all gave me their answer here. Here we go. What do you think was your best Olympia? Now, years later, looking back, what was your favorite or your best Olympia? Anyone?
Oh, go ahead. We'll go with the GOAT. Go ahead, Haney.
Well, like Sean was saying, 91, and I'll tell you what happened. I had a tendency, you know, because I always stay within striking distance. But I had the tendency the last 5 weeks I would go to a straight six training routine,
mm-hmm.
which ended up leaving me just a little bit soft and a little bit fatigued as I came closer to the contest. And only about 3 days before the show, after I feel out that my body started to sort of recover. But for the last Olympia, I stayed and proud. To that six or straight six, 5 weeks out, I would use a 3-on-off-1. So the last Olympia, I stayed with the 3-on-off-1. I stayed full the entire time. The body looked healthy. The muscles were full. I wasn't fatigued. And guess what? Perfect peak. Just like Sean was saying, but, you know, I guess, you know, I had enough juice in the tank and enough of all the other things needed to win to keep me afloat and winning during those other deals. But the last one, I agree, Sean, that was the best. I know the reason, it felt easier training for that particular show than the other ones because guess what? I wasn't overtraining.
Was that your favorite personal experience, Lee, winning that last one in 91? Was that better than 84?
Listen, man. Well, 84 was like a dream come true.
Yeah.
91 was like waiting to exhale.
Mission accomplished.
I had all these cats try to kill me, as I said. So
yeah.
that was it for me. People said, well, Lee, you didn't announce your retirement. I didn't have to. I knew that was it.
Yeah.
You know, and I was able to move on, was ready to move on and use my success in other deals. So it was a, it was it. It was no wanting to come back, man. I was finished. Ah, that was it. I was shocked. I had nothing else left to give.
Yeah. That's a great way to go. That was a great way to go out. I mean, being a fan of the sport, I watched a lot of careers come and go. I don't think anyone had a better send off than that.
Yeah. Hey, Rich, how about you? You got second 3 years in a row. Was any one of those particularly the most important or the one that meant the most to you?
I think 88 was probably like my best year that I mean, as Sean was saying, you know, when I was biting at Lee's heels from 85, 86, 87, I kept trying to like beat him. I decided when I went into 88, I was just going to go in the best shape that I could be in to go on that show. And the winner, you know, the winner takes all, whoever's going to win. And I went into that show. It was a great experience. You know, I came in, I still was able to keep second. Mm-hmm. And only, you know, Lee talks about all these assassins. Well, I was the guy second, but all the other guys behind, like Lee Labrada and Barry DeMay, all wanting to beat me to get into that second place spot. So I did that. And then going to those Grand Prix and then winning the, you know, the Arnold. So that period. And then unfortunately I got injured and things started going downhill from there.
Yeah.
With my body, which just wasn't responding because I, you know, I pushed my body to the limits to go against genetic freaks like Lee Labrada and Lee Haney. I really had to push my body to the limits to get it to look the way it did.
Yeah, it seemed like 88 was the year where a lot of guys just came into their best. They said, whatever happens, I'm just going to come in my absolute best. You know, Barry DeMay did it also. Lee Labrada did it also.
Mike Quinn, too. Mike Quinn.
Yeah, Mike Quinn. Yeah.
Didn't have a pretty body, but he was in shape.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was a great Olympia. How about you, Lee?
You know what, John? I want to say that, you know, in my mindset was never to go on stage and beat anybody. That wasn't the mindset that I had. From day one, I said, listen, this bodybuilding is saying Arnold and Robbie, Zane, Platts, these are the kings of bodybuilding. Then I said to myself, what can I do to become a combination of all of these different people? Forget the legs of Platts. I love his presentation, you know. Arnold was, he was weird, totally different. So I always each year tried to be better than the Lee Haney of the previous year. I never tried to compete against anyone. I just tried to look like what bodybuilding said it wanted to see and look like. Mm-hmm. And so when you see people like Lee Labrada, like Rich, you know, like Sean, we were the best of the best at what we were gifted with genetically. And through hard work and determination and having the scientific knowledge of nutrition, we could never compete against each other. Really, it was all left up to the eye of the beholders, which were the judges. Mm-hmm. You can't do anything about that.
Yeah.
So you just have to bring the best you that you can bring with the best presentation. And hopefully the chips will fall where they may. And then at the end of the game, okay, how can I take all of this hard work and dedication and turn it into an economy? And I can say all of us speaking with you today, being able to take our fantasy of bodybuilding and our hard work and be able to forge a living with it.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
Amen.
Yeah. It's crazy because I'm looking at the length of all of our careers, but there was only 2 years in our careers where we were all on the same stage. The 1988 Olympia in Los Angeles, in the 1991 Olympia. It was the only two times that we were all on the same stage in our careers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the 88 Olympia and the 91 are both historic, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, the 88 Olympia was just on another level because it was my first. I'm a rookie, and I'm up there with my idols for me personally. That was just Los Angeles, the Olympia. It was just huge. I remember all the stars that were in the house, Gregory Hines. Think about the personalities that were at that show watching us. So when we had the weigh-in,
yeah.
I remember when Gaspari weighed in, I go, he's too light. He's too small. Who are you, Rich? 207 pounds, 204 pounds that year?
I was like 208, 208.
Yeah, you were small. I just thought, because I remember you competed heavier, right? So,
yeah.
But then you showed off the conditioning. It was ridiculous. And then, of course, in 91, You know, I had won the Arnold Classic, and I thought it was just going to be me against Haney. And, of course, Dorian Yates upset the apricot there. And, of course, Librato is still spoiling and killing me. But that was that. Those 2 years were stand out amongst all of my career with you guys on that stage during 1988 and 99. Great memories.
Yeah. Hey, Lee Librato, how about you? What Olympia stands out for you, the one that was most special, the ones that you were in?
John, you know what? I'm gonna pick up where Lee Haney left off, and I'm gonna say that it's the journey, it's the path that makes all of us as champions. In other words, it's not, you know, a highlight of one particular year. Sure, I took second before, you know, I took some thirds, took some fourths, et cetera. You know, they all have their special moments and that type of thing. But I'm going to say it's the path that makes the champions. Mm-hmm. You know, and by the grace of God, we've been able to live out a dream. Each one of us have been able to live out a dream that many can only fantasize about. And then not only that, but to transition over and to be able to continue making a living, you know, from a sport that we love and we cherish and to stay involved in. So for me, it was really just about the just the multitude of the years. You mm-hmm. know, the first one in 87 stands out to me only because I remember the auditorium in Sweden being so packed with people. Yeah. You know, and the lights so blinding that as I was stepping on stage, I could only see the silhouettes of the heads. Guys, you remember what that looked like back in the day. And the flash bulbs start going off because it wasn't digital photography back then. And I thought to myself, oh, my God. And when I put that first foot on the stage, yeah. it's I am stepping on hallowed ground. This yeah. is the contest that Oliva competed in, that Schwarzenegger competed in, that Larry Scott competed in. You know, I'm sitting there looking around at guys that I'd only seen in magazines, and I thought to myself, oh my God, it's like, it's got to be the feeling that a football player gets going into the Super Bowl for the first time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Amen.
All right. And finally, our last clip of the day for our sixth anniversary, part three of our sixth anniversary show. This is the great Rick Wayne. So I interviewed Rick last fall, and it was a three-part interview, and I'm trying to get Rick back on the show. So hopefully we can get him back on soon because I know he's got some more stories to tell. So I just put together a bunch of clips. This was from part three of our interview with Rick, and he has a bunch of stories here about Arnold, and about Sergio, and about his idol, Steve Reeves, who he was supposed to do an interview with, and, of course, Joe Weider. So here's the great Rick Wayne. Can you tell me how good Arnold and Sergio looked in their prime? I mean, you got to see them. You were on stage. You competed with Sergio and at Mr. Universe.
Yeah,
you competed with Arnold and Mr. Universe. How good were they? I mean, just to try and give our listeners an idea.
Sergio was phenomenal. And he would have been in his best shape. Sergio would still be phenomenal.
Yeah, even today.
Because he had this tiny waist, he had the broad shoulders.
Yeah.
But the sad part is Sergio never got close to what I think he could have been. He yeah. never had those separations that he could have had.
Yeah.
And would still be able to maintain the body size.
Yeah.
You know, he never had that. And that's why I say he was blessed with this phenomenal body. But at the end of the day, Arnold, every day in a contest, I would put Arnold ahead. Because Arnold was their posing ability. Sergio had one or two shots. The shot up there, front or back, that was great.
Yeah.
Sergio's double bicep shot. Sergio did not have great biceps. There was no peak to it. There were huge arms.
Yeah.
But Arnold had a peak.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and Arnold always showed himself at best angles, the muscles that were the best, that's what you saw.
Yeah.
But Sergio just, he didn't think. Sergio's bodybuilding had nothing to do with intellect. To beat Arnold, you had to get into his mind.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't just compete against a guy with muscles. The guy was tall. He was always impeccable. He was always on. He was funny. He knew how to work a crowd. I remember one time we were in San Jose, and that was after the Whitney Museum of Art. When did you remember that thing?
Yeah.
And Arnold comes and does a show. I was in San Jose then. with him for whatever reason. I was there and we were sharing the same suite. So there's the theater. And it was the pictures and everything. And Arnold comes on. And of course, they went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But Arnold, as you know, was skinny.
Yeah.
Because he had dropped all this weight for this museum thing, whatever it was, with Frank Zane and who was there, Ed Corney.
Ed Corney, yeah.
Et cetera. So that evening, we're in the room talking, and I said to him, Arnold, how you were so white, and you look skinny. And he says, so what? I said, so what? He said, did you feel bad standing up in front of that crowd in that kind of shape? And he said, Ricky, whose picture was outside on the billboards? And all? I said, Arnold. He said, Arnold who? I said, what do you mean Arnold? He said, Arnold who? I said, Arnold, Mr. Olympia. He said, who did the audience turn out to see? I said, Arnold. He said, stop there. Did they see Arnold? I said, yeah. He said, well, they got what they came for. If they want to see me in Mr. Olympia shape, come to the Olympia. Right. Now, what are you going to say to that?
Right, right. That's a great idea. That's a great point.
But what are you going to say that Arnold is not going to knock himself out for a show?
Yeah, yeah.
As far as he's concerned, his name will carry him there. The Arnold fans, if he stood on his neck, they would still be applauding.
Right.
And they bought the tickets, and he's been paid.
Yeah.
It's like the famous one I wrote about him holding the envelope up to the light
to the light,
early
yeah.
days. And right. kept tossing every now and again. He tossed the envelope into the trash. You know right. the story, right?
Right.
And I said to him, why are you doing that? And he says, no money, no checks. I said, but what if there is a check in there and you know, because he doesn't even open it. He just holds it up to the light. And I said, well, what if there's a check in there? He said, if there's a check in there, they'll call me again.
Right.
And those were early days.
I know. Amazing. So,
and Arnold did not go to any kind of Harvard or anything.
Right.
But
right.
he didn't need to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Arnold could start his own school.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder where it came from, you know, because you look at his beginning.
I mean, parents. I know it bothered Lee. Now all these guys, it's good to see everybody friendly now and everybody's good, but they weren't always friendly.
Yeah.
Okay. And I know Lee was not happy with how he felt the magazines were treating him as opposed to Arnold, because yeah. he felt he had won so many Olympias and he wasn't quite getting what Arnold got.
Yeah.
And he had a point, but nobody could compare themselves with Arnold. Arnold would walk into the Wheeler building where everybody knew him and everybody would still come out, hey, Arnold! They wouldn't do it to anybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
For Rick Noe would come in there, so what?
Yeah.
Even at the height of his Hulk.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It didn't matter.
There's yeah. only one Arnold, and it's good that he's still associated with it. But the bodybuilding he represents is gone.
Yeah, I know.
There was this contest where that iconic picture was taken, that same session.
Okay.
And Draper had posed. No, he hadn't posed. Draper came, and Draper was Joe's boy before Arnold. There was Draper.
Yeah.
There was Sergio. Well, Larry Scott.
Yeah.
And all those guys.
Chuck Sipes.
Yeah. Chuck Sipes didn't belong in that picture. He ran. He just ran. When the shot was taken, I don't think all the shots have Chuck Collaris in them. Chuck Sipes. Oh, yeah. He said.
Oh, so you're talking about the group picture? Okay.
I didn't really know Chuck Sipes at all. I guess. It was not one of my favorite bodybuilders either. But at that time, that iconic picture was taken. Draper said he Sergio and Draper and the rest of them were grumbling together.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnold was instigating a lot of that. Make sure you get paid and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. And those were early days. So when it came time for Draper to pose, who knew Joe Weider forever, he wouldn't pose until Joe gave him a check.
Yeah.
And just says, what the hell? You know, I'll send you a check. He said, I want my check now. And that went on with two or three other guys. And Joe had no checkbook, as usual, and certainly no cash. And the guy who normally did carry that was a guy called John Lima, and he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So, because Joe normally sent the checks out maybe late, but he normally sent checks out to the guys. But now they wanted to paid before they posed, and Caruso is waiting there.
Yeah.
And of course, I've been listening to Arnold stirring it up with these guys.
Why was he doing that?
It's coming. So it's a mess now because he doesn't have the money, Joe, and the guys won't trust him, etc. And Arnold says, "Oh, I have the money. I will." So there was Arnold's Olympia money,
mm-hmm.
and he had other money. He gave it to Joe, and Joe paid. Now you know. I tell you afterwards. It's as if Joe had met the Blessed Virgin. Arnold, such a nice guy. And it never occurred to him that Arnold had set up this whole thing.
Yeah.
And Dave was going through one of his, you know.
Yeah.
So, unforgettable. That's Arnold again. We keep going back to him.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
The goody things, the twisted things, the clever things, the manipulative things. That is Arnold. But that was a personality.
Yeah.
All of the, whereas most of the guys was what you see, what you get. That's it. Nothing more.
Yeah.
When I talk to people about Reeves, I wrote something on Facebook on that recently. A guy saw somebody actually describe, he was not an English speaking person. So he used the word beautiful as a non-English speaking person. Mm-hmm. And I said, I like that because whenever I talk about Reeves, whether to young people or school, I always referred to Reeves as beautiful. And that was my first real inspiration was Steve Reeves.
Yeah.
Reeves was not handsome. Reeves was pretty, beautiful. Yeah. Oh, God.
Right.
I mean, you look at some of the pictures that because now they're releasing all kinds of things, and you see, well, but the pictures that we knew were perfection.
Yeah.
Picture him walking down on that movie set. That one with the sword and lean over.
Those pictures.
Nobody can take that. And
no.
That face.
Yeah.
And that face, those bones. Oh, and it was tall. And they were everything.
Yeah.
Funny thing happened. I was a reader and I got a call once and said, this is Rick Wayne. This is Steve Reeves. I said, yeah, right. I said, no, this is Steve Reeves. And I'm a big fan of your writing. And I've decided I want to do a book and I want you to write it.
Hmm.
And when you think of it, and here was my God.
Yeah.
I never did get to meet him. We talked a while. I took notes and all that kind of stuff and he died.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I never got to meet him. And which is perhaps a good thing because the image I had of him was 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, you're 80 or something. So
yeah,
it's like I had an opportunity to meet Elvis, and by that time he was gone. He was, I just didn't want to. I'm the ultimate Elvis Presley fan.
Oh yeah, okay.
Oh man. but if I was going to see him at all, I wanted to see him at the time of Vegas. And King Creole, not
at the older Elvis. Yeah. Did you see that movie, Rick, about Elvis, the new one?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought
everybody thinks it's good, but yeah. I can't help thinking that nothing I would see would take the place of Elvis because I mean Elvis was the guy who I was gaga over as a teen.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So you don't forget.
You were a singer too.
That's right.
Yeah.
How long and all of my reviews said how much I sounded like Elvis.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Every record review I had.
How long did that career last? You're singing?
About 5 years.
Okay.
I recorded for CBS. They had an affiliate. Yeah, and also a company called Pi. Pi
Records. Okay. What kind of singing was it? What kind of song?
Oh, rock. Yeah. From Don't Be Cruel to King Creole.
No kidding. No.
All that. And Jerry Lee Lewis, a whole lot of shaking going on. Okay. That was my kind of stuff.
And you sang at one of Bud Parker's shows, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. There's another one. We were in Philadelphia, and I emceed. I did a few things on the show, and I sang. And I remember I closed the first half with that Buddy Holly song, It Doesn't Matter Anymore. Mm-hmm. But I guess it doesn't matter anymore. And Leroy Corbett and all the guys in the front row, they've never heard me sing before. Wow. So I get off the stage, and as I'm walking to Joe Wheeler and all of them in the front row, they're all excited, you know. And Joe is just like that, you know. What? So I shook hands with the guys, congrats, Ricky, you're great, blah, 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 blah. And then I sit down with Joe. I said, what's the problem, Joe? He says, Ricky, you know how many guys would like to write like you? A lot. You know how many guys wish they had your physique? A lot. You remember? You know how many guys wish this, wish that? And you can do all of those things. And I'm thinking there's a compliment coming there.
Yeah.
It's no wonder you're so fucked up. I miss Joe Wheeler. I really miss Joe. I think I probably would have come back to California if Joe, Arnold and I talked about everything. Some subjects we didn't talk about because they might cause a stir if he was in the mood.
Okay.
For example, well, this is a lot earlier when Arnold first came, right at the time he was doing this famous Hercules in New York, that bomb.
Yeah.
So there we were at the Sheraton Hotel in the dining room, myself, Franco, a few others, and Joe Wheeler. Betty Wheeler was at the time in California. So Joe Wheeler had his penthouse and he had this blue Cadillac.
Okay.
Arnold walks in. Hi, guys. And he goes straight to the hat check girl who had just come in a few minutes earlier, a black girl, a hat check. He goes to the girl, talks to her, comes back, goes again, and then he comes back to Joe. Joe, can I borrow your car and your penthouse? I mean, if Arnold asked Joe to jump up the Times building, he would do it. So I give him the keys, and Arnold is gone. So the next morning, I learned, by the way, Joe was sitting by himself for a long time. The next morning, Arnold comes to the office, sits down, and he's talking to me about this wonderful time he had with this girl.
Yeah.
And bragging. So, and then he gets up. And as he's going out my cubicle, he says, and Ricky, she says, I am the best she ever had. And he walks out the cubicle, then pokes his head back, including the black guys.
Of course. Yeah, no, that was coming, right?
Oh, those stories. Arnold was, because there were times I would say to him, I can't believe what's happening to you, man. Yeah. You know, because I knew Arnold all the way back in London and Germany.
Yeah.
And you know, Arnold, look what's happening. And it's just happening. Everything can be tumbling his way. This guy can't do anything wrong. He has the guy with a Midas touch and everything. So I said, look, I can't believe this. You know, what is it about you, man? And he said, well, I am good looking. I have the greatest physique in the world. I am smart. And again, he walks out and he pokes his head the same way. And I'm white. You see, that is the humor. He knew the kind of stuff lagging.
The fun to push, right?
so he will hold that until he gets out of the office, the cubicle, and he's on his way out.
Right.
He drops that. But he's a generous guy. You know, I would ask Arnold for interviews. And imagine this, the control Arnold had as well. How many bodybuilders would get an opportunity to do interviews for Flex and Muscle and Fitness at the time, and they would say no, which for later? And if they get an opportunity to be in there every day, they would be in there. Not Arnold. It got to a time when Arnold would not do interviews and tell me, let's hold it. Because he had something to promote.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of Arnold's background, you wonder where he acquired this kind of perspicacity, you know. And that's what you don't hear people talking about. Right. They just figure, but Arnold was a different kind of bodybuilder. Arnold himself is a different kind of man.
Yeah.
And that's what made him the champion he was.
All right. That was great stuff. Love hearing from Rick Wayne. He was definitely one of my favorite interviews over the last 6 years. So can't wait to talk to him again. I am in contact with Rick every once in a while, which is an honor to talk to him. So hopefully we can get him back on the show, like I said. All right, guys. Well, that is it for our 6th anniversary. I hope you guys enjoyed all 3 parts, and I hope you enjoyed this one as well. If you got any comments or suggestions about guests you want to see on the show, just send them to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll be sure to read your email on the air. Until then, we will see you guys next time. I want to thank again our Patreon sponsors for continuing to sponsor the show. If anybody out there is interested in being a Patreon sponsor and helping to sponsor the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you can just check out the link below or go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link for the Patreon page in the upper right-hand corner. All right, guys, we will see you next week. So until then, stay safe, keep training hard, and we'll see you then. All right, take care.